7:30.
He's gonna come to the Lucas Hennep's chair, so.
Would I be able to...
He's not going to email you.
Could I get
through
on his
stack? You think he could go, he's only not getting it.
Into her practice walks a lesbian couple. One was Jewish and one was not Jewish. And the non-Jewish partner was wearing a yarmulke and tzitzis, despite the fact that she's a shiksa. So the two questions that come out of this, one sort of hashkafic is, when we are confronted with situations like this, how should we deal with it? And the second question is, what specific isurim were they over, if anything?
Well, you're allowed to give lesbians glasses. That's not a, you know, that's not a lifnei either. I mean, now there is a discussion in Paiskim, for example. If you're a landlord, and a couple comes to you that's Isaac, they're going to live together in a prohibited relationship, mishkav zachar, lesbianism, or even a man and a woman that are not married. Is it considered to be lifnei iver by providing them a place to live where they could do what they're doing improperly? And even there, where you're actually giving them the place where they're going to do the aveira, we paskin that it's not lifnei iver, because if you don't rent it to them, somebody else will rent it to them. And the Gemara says that is not lifnei iver. And even though there's a rabbinic rule called misayeh, you're not allowed to help people do a sin, even if they could do it without you, that's midrabanan, that's not lifnei iver, but that's only if you directly help them. For example, you give them the non-kosher food, but renting them a house is indirect, and we paskin it's mutter. So kal v'chomer would be the case, giving them glasses or whatever it is, that has no shaychus, they could do their aver without glasses, so you're not really with them in any way. Now the question is, do you have to give tochacha? Do you have to give muster? Hey, you can't do this. Well, I mean, the short answer is that if somebody is not going to listen to your tochacha, there's no point in bringing it up. And Chazal have different ways of expressing it. Sometimes they say better to be shogeg than to be a mezid, whatever it is. Or that's one maimer Chazal. Another Maimer Chazal is that the same way it's a mitzvah to say something that will be listened to, it is a mitzvah not to say something that will not be listened to. So by and large, there's really nothing you're supposed to do, and maybe nothing you even should do, because it might make it worse. Agav di agav, the truth of the matter is that female lesbianism is not as chomer at all as male homosexuality. Female lesbianism is not a chi of skila, it's not one of the arayos, it is considered to be something improper, but Rav Moshe writes in a tshuva that it's not even clear that there's any isur di araisa at all. And the truth of the matter is, even with a non-Jew, that doesn't make it worse, because without getting graphic, I mean, whatever women are doing is not together, is not gili arayos. Physically, it's not gili arayos, and if it's not gili arayos, then whether it's two women that are both Jewish, or a woman, one is Jewish, one is not Jewish, there is no maise erva that is being done per se. So b'sach hakol, I would say you don't have to do anything. Now there are many, many shaylos. This is going to come up in so many contexts. If you're a landlord, that's one issue. If you're a caterer, if you bake a cake, I mean, l'mashal, let's say, you know, you do cakes, right? And you do inscriptions. So, Anne and Betty come in, you know, and say, you know, we want a cake saying congratulations to Anne and Betty's, you know, third anniversary. Are you allowed to write an inscription, you know, saying congratulations on your third anniversary? that would be very different, because there you're directly endorsing an improper relationship. By the way, in the United States at least, I don't know what the law in Israel is, these are actual cases, and usually with religious Christians have refused to do this. They have been fined by the government for violation of civil rights. There are cases where a business had to pay several $100,000 because they didn't want to write such a thing, and even though they argued that it was against their freedom of religion. So Lemaisa, at least in the United States, this is going to be an issue where more and more people are going to be forced, really, to endorse relationships that are against halacha because of discrimination and everything else. You already know that in the United States, gay marriage has been legitimated, and it is even unconstitutional. It's against the U.S. Constitution for a state to prohibit gay marriage. They're mechuyev to allow it. Of course, without getting into that so much, because that wasn't your question, I just want to remind everybody of the Gemara in Chulin that says Sodom was destroyed not because people practiced homosexual relations, but because they did it by writing a ksuba. They made it like a marriage as opposed to just doing an avera b'taiva, which is a good reason to tell your friends to come to Eretz Yisrael, although we have our problems here too, but at least come to Eretz Yisrael, and, you know, because America, who knows what America is going to go through. Yeah?
With the Isser of Shadness, so are you allowed to try something on if you don't know, and why would that be?
Yeah, it is a good kasha. There is a hetter to try a garment on before you check it for shatness, and there would be two different reasons for it. One might be that if it's not from the sug that is known to be shatness for sure, like Italian suits or whatever it is, so you are allowed to follow the majority, and the majority is not shatness. But if you knew it was shatness according to that svara, it would be usur. The second svara that the poskim say, which is a little harder to understand, is that the isser of shatness is only if you are intending to get the benefit from the garment by the warmth and the like. And that's why the Gemara says that people who sell clothing, and in those days they used to carry their clothing by either wearing it or draping it around their shoulders, are allowed to do so even if they know it's shatness, because they're not mechaven for levisha. Now, many poskim say that is the heter to try on a suit because you're not mechavein for levisha, but I think it's very difficult, because here's the problem. The problem basically is that may be true for a jacket, because you could say, I really don't want to wear the jacket, I just want to see if it fits me. But if it's pants, for example, you certainly want to wear the pants, because without the pants you would be naked. So to say you're not getting benefit from the pants, I think you are, at least in the narrow sense, that you're not being embarrassed standing in your underwear. But it could be that pants, the emes is you always have a row, because even in suits that are vadai shatness, the shatness is normally not located in the pants. So on the jacket, there is the heter that you're not mechavein to wear it, you're not getting benefit from wearing it, and for the pants, the heter would be because it's a row, that's a majority. So. Yep.
Even if you're in the fitting room and there's no public, no one's looking at you, so can we not say that's smart?
Yeah, in the fitting room you could say that's smart. In the fitting room you could, yeah, but if you have a tailor looking at you to see what needs to be altered, you'd have a problem, yeah.
In regards to homosexuality, what is the necessity, according to the Rambam, that there should be three lavim against it? Both any kind of, with a father and an uncle?
Yeah, the reason is, again, the Rambam himself writes that these were the taivas and taivas that were especially prevalent among the Canaanim and among the Mitzrim, so the Torah had to single them out. And if you say, well, we don't have that Yetzirah anymore, remember the Gemara says in Maseches Yuma that after the Anshei Knesset HaGdola took away the Yetzirah for idolatry, because that was too overpowerful, and Hashem took away that Yetzirah, they then were mispalel that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should take away the Yetzer for Arayos. And that was granted. That was a great thing. But then people weren't getting married, people weren't having children, so we needed the Yetzer for good things. So we got it back. But the Gemara's Maskana is, but Afilu Hachi, Hashem answered part of our prayers by taking away the Yetzer for incest. And that is why a normal person, at least, has no taiva to have sexual relations with a close relative. So as a result, therefore, we don't really understand the need for certain prohibitions simply because we don't have the Yetzer Hara anymore. But it's mashra from the Gemara that until that point, the taiva for incestuous relations was a very, very powerful taiva, perhaps even more powerful than regular sexual taiva. And Lagabi Mishkav Zocher, it was even more so. So as a result, the Torah had to be madgish, those prohibitions. Yeah.
My question is, which one is worse, L'chor? Is it worse to be in a category of a lady that wears a very long shetel that's 22 inches and tight clothing, or is it worse to be one of those Brook ladies that covers the whole face and acts like a ghost? is any category doing Isra Daraisa, basically? And if they are, which one is doing Isra Daraisa? And if that group is doing the Isra Daraisa, is it better to be the other type than the other type?
Well, that's a very interesting question. You know, the burqa ladies are not over on any clear d'oraisa. That's very 100% correct. So, from a pure halachic standpoint, better to have too much than too little. The burqa lady is not over on any beferish d'oraisa. And in fact, she might be dressing the way, perhaps, we don't know for sure, women, you know, Jewish women dressed a very, very long time ago. But I have to say that the burqa ladies is clearly Ein Ruach Chachamim Neichaimenu. It's a Dover Pashat that the Gedalim have considered to be very, very improper, because if part of the idea of Tznius is not to attract attention to the way you're behaving, if you behave totally Yaitzim in a cloud of even religious women, you become very, very, a woman. The woman becomes very conspicuous. People stare, or people think. Yeah. And in their mind, there's a machshava, who is this a woman and the like. And number two, the philosophy of the burqa lady is even at home, they're that way. And Chazal were very machbin that with the husband, a woman should try to be attractive. Mm-hmm. And I know that the husbands, at least of most of these women, don't like it. This is really, they are rebelling against their husbands. And the like. So, if you're asking me, you know, what's better? Okay, you know, it's probably better to do that than to walk into the street in a preetzus way. But it's certainly not a mahalach that a woman should engage in. It undermines shalom bayis. Besides the fact that at least some of these women are crazy, because it turns into child abuse. It's a whole bunch of stuff that's connected. And I'm not saying it's muchrich that from this will come to that, but it happens to be that the women who listen to their teachers, their rebbetzins who tell them this, are involved in other things as well, which are not good. So it's not a good inyan to be nischaber to that. Yeah.
How did Tehillim become such an integral part of our davening?
Yeah, well, remember that this is not a later addition. This comes from the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. The Anshei Knesset HaGdola themselves...
How did they decide?
Yeah, well, they decided, because Tehillim, after all... What is Tehillim? Tehillim, after all, are prayers. Most of Tehillim is David HaMelech speaking to Hashem, asking Hashem for assistance. Now, when the Anshei Knesset HaGdola are trying to find what are the best words to turn to God in prayer, they look at the prayers that themselves were sanctified through divine inspiration, because the Tehillim, if Tehillim is part of Tanakh, it is a product of Ruach HaKodesh. And David HaMelech was a Navi, although Tehillim is not Nevuah, because it's Kesuvim, it's not Nevi'im, but it is divinely inspired. So Tehillim became the basis of the Siddur, and in fact, even phrases in Shemona Esrei, phrases, a lot of them are taken from Tehillim. Now, Chazal say that when David HaMelech wrote the Tehillim, or he compiled them together, he actually prayed to Hashem that may my words be studied and said, just like Negoyim and Oelos, which are very hard tractates of the Mishnah. And Hashem, you know, David's tefillah was answered, that indeed Tehillim became the repository of all of those emotions, all of those feelings. What do they say? They say that in Tehillim, I talk to Hashem. When I learn Torah, Hashem is talking back to me, Hashem, right? So there's kind of this dialogue. Tehillim, unfortunately, you know, we take Tehillim for granted, like we take a lot of things for granted. But a person should be ragil to say Tehillim, both in davening, the Pesukim in the Zimra, and outside of davening as well. This, now, Tehillim, as you know, is divided in many ways. There's Tehillim that's divided into days of the week. There's Tehillim that is divided days of the month, which is lesser, you know, fewer Tehillim, and the like. There are some people, although this would take a while, that they say the whole Sefer of Tehillim every day. There are Kolalim in Kever Rachel that say Tehillim at, you know, every night, you know, how many Yeshuas and how many salvations have been brought to Klal Yisrael because of Tehillim? So there's a Gemara that says if a person wants to be a chassid, I don't mean a Baal Shem Tov chassid necessarily, but if a person wants to be a pious person, he should be Isaac in the saying of Tehillim. So it's really, the Brisker Rav used to say, it was a very, very precious treasure. In fact, I'll tell you a little maisa here, that the Brisker Rav and his whole family, and probably the Briskers do it today, I don't know, on Rosh Hashanah, every spare minute, they were saying Tehillim. You know, but after davening, they would just say Tehillim. So somebody came to the Brisker Rav on Rosh Hashanah, he saw everybody saying Tehillim, including the Brisker Rav. And he said to the Brisker Rav, is there somebody that's sick? Like, why are you all saying Tehillim? The Brisker Rav says, well, on Rosh Hashanah, we're all sick because, you know, Hashem is judging us, we're all b'sakrana, so we say Tehillim. So someone asked the Brisker Rav, I mean, but a person like the Rav, you can certainly learn Gemara, you could be Isaac B'Torah, why are you saying Tehillim? So the Brisker Rav said, at an Eis Sara, even though Torah in some ways is more powerful, but your mind can wander, you get up to get a sefer, people interrupt you with akasha, etc. My love to Tehillim is you can be continuous. You don't have to get up, you don't have to switch, look up this and look up that. So he said at a point when your mind needs to be focused, he actually said Tehillim was a better thing. P.A. Sorry, yeah.
You're learning the Pasha, I think it was this week's Pasha, I'm not sure, but Moshe, it was at Har Sinai, Moshe says to Hashem, because Hashem threatens to destroy the Jewish people after the golden calf. So then he pleads to Hashem and says, one of the reasons behind him pleading on Hashem to save the Jewish people is he says, if you don't, it will be a Chilul Hashem.
Yes.
So my question to you is, how is it possible for Hashem to commit a Chilul Hashem against himself? It would seem to defy...
Well, actually, that's a very interesting question. But actually, that's a very common theme. That is kind of our backup argument when everything else fails. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, remember Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and remember how good they were. But there are times in which we're so bad that the Zuchus of the Avais is not going to help us, and the like. So the last-ditch argument that Moshe Rabbeinu always makes, and he makes it several places in the Torah, is, okay, God, we don't deserve anything at all. We have no merit at all. But if you get rid of us, the Goyim are going to say you don't have power, and your name is going to be desecrated. In Avinu Malkeinu, remember Avinu Malkeinu is the long, long litany of forgive us, help us, you know. The last thing, next to the last thing says, Asei lamancha im lo lamaneinu, do it for your sake. And Asei manu tztaka v'chesed. So Chilul Hashem, logically it is possible for God himself to have his name desecrated if by God's behavior the nations of the world say that either God doesn't have the power. In other words, look at what Moshe Rabbeinu says. What is the Chilul Hashem that Moshe Rabbeinu identifies? That if you destroy the people, the Goyim, the nations, will say you didn't have the power to defeat the powerful Canaanite deities. And that's why you had to kill the Jews, because you didn't want to lose the battle. It's like saying, I'm going to commit suicide before this guy kills me. Now, that is a Chilul Hashem, because that is a behavior which will cause the nations to say that Hashem doesn't have power. So yeah, it is possible for HaKadosh Baruch Hu Kav Yochel to do something that will result in the rest of the world losing reverence. Now, it doesn't, in a literal sense, take away God's power. But Chilul is based on perception. It is not based on reality. The reality, the perception is that Hashem doesn't have power, right? So that's Chilul Hashem.
Yeah, then my first question is, could you commit Chilul Hashem in private if it's based on others' perception? And my second question would be, if you had to follow halacha, like they'd say in Europe with the shitta. So now you're following halacha. Could that be a chilul Hashem?
Okay, so a few things. Chilul Hashem can exist in private, and that's because chilul Hashem has a few definitions. One definition of chilul Hashem is behavior that causes other people to think that Hashem's Torah is bad or Hashem doesn't have power to help the Jewish people. That is the chilul Hashem of public desecration of God's name. That is what Moshe Rabbeinu is using against HaKadosh Baruch Hu in his argument. But the Rambam says there is also chilul Hashem privately, in the sense that not that other people are influenced, but you yourself are making a declaration, chas v'shalom, that God's Torah is not important. So the Rambam says in Hilchos Atshuva, Hilchos Yesedi HaTorah, that if a person commits sins out of a sense of indifference, nonchalance, he just doesn't care, that is a desecration of God's name, not in the eyes of other people, but you are making a statement that God doesn't matter. So that's called the Chilul Hashem too. Now, the last thing, if I understood you correctly, can following halacha be a chilul Hashem? This is a very interesting question. Rav Meir Simcha, the Or Sameach, actually says that if you follow halacha exactly, but people think it's stupid, or people think it's primitive, or people think it's old-fashioned, that is their problem, that is not your problem. I mean, a very good example is davening. You know, let's say you're in a train station. Okay, Eretz Yisrael is less of a problem because it's part of society. But let's say you're in the States, you're in a train station or a bus station and or an airport, and you have to daven mincha. Now, if you daven mincha in a way that blocks people, like on a plane, you block the bathroom or whatever it is, that is a chilul Hashem, because you're doing a behavior that shows that a religious Jew doesn't care about other people. That is absolutely a chilul Hashem. But let's say you're davening in a private, secluded area, you're not disturbing anybody, you're not bothering anybody, but people walk by, either Jews or non-Jews, often it'll be Jews, that say, how primitive is this person? God, this person can't keep his religion, you know, to himself. Why is he showing off, etc.? And they look at an Orthodox Jew and they say, this is a bad, stupid thing. But what is a bad, stupid thing? The fact that you're davening? So Rav Meir Simcha says that cannot be a chilul Hashem, because you're doing exactly what Hashem wants you to do at that moment. So you have to be mechalek between somebody who is critical of a religious Jew because he's davening versus somebody who's critical of a religious Jew because he's blocking access to the bathroom. The second one is chilul Hashem. The first one is not. Right? You can't be over on chilul. In other words, you don't have a responsibility for all of the krum, all of the wrong ideas that people have about Yiddishkeit. That is their problem, and you're not guilty. But you do have an achrayus. If you did anything wrong in part of when you did the mitzvah, that's going to be a chilul Hashem. Yeah.
I want to ask about a halach topic. I heard that many big poskim, like after the Ashram of Vozno or Rabbi Yosef, they forbid to wear women's shaitas, and it's not news and also, and the women have dafka lechatkila to wear the handkerchief. Well,
yeah.
I am not sure. Is it like what I heard it from somebody? I wanted to clarify: is it the truth or?
Of course it's the truth. But it is a very very big machlokas, as you may know. Hopefully, maybe you don't notice these things. It's better. Among American B'nai Torah, you know, people who come here for a few years and then go back, having a shaitel is, or in America itself, wearing a shaitel is the norm, and that is very, very makubal, that the prohibition of married women to go out with uncovered hair does not apply if they're wearing a wig, even if it's human hair. But many of the Gedolim, maybe most of the Gedolim in Eretz Yisrael, Ashkenazim and Sephardim, Rav Yashuv, Rav Adi Yosef, they have more or less been against the idea of a shaitel. Sorry?
Can I add something?
Yeah.
I spoke to two Talmidim of Rav Yashuv.
Yeah.
And they told me that they heard from Rav Yashuv that that's not what he's, that what is said in his name
yeah.
is not true. The street is named.
Well, they say the street is not true. Yeah, I understand.
They told them that they could wear a shaitel.
Okay, that would be interesting. It's hard to say. It's true that he's represented in the street as saying it's the biggest aveira, and that I understand is not entirely true. But I'm surprised that he matred lechatchila because lechol apachais, it seems that he said it was better not to. That's okay. But you said you heard even lechatchila. Okay. But be it as it may, it is a machlokas. One cannot say absolutely everybody says that it is usher. Now, having said that, there is shaitels and there is shaitels, right? Because after all, the swara of covering hair is that a woman's hair might be attractive, etc., and it's wrong for her to go out. I mean, that's the ultimate swara here. So if it's a beautiful shaitel, if it's a very long shaitel, that attracts the eye, if it's a very fancy shaitel. So even if one has fulfilled the technical requirement that the hair be covered, it's still something, as I used the expression before, ein ruach chachamim neichaimenu, the chachamim don't like it. It's a priestess type of behavior. So even those who matir shaitels don't necessarily matir, or don't encourage long shaitels and the like. But it is a machlokas. I mean, in this neighborhood in particular, you will tend to see a lot of signs that shaitels are absolutely, categorically, 1,000% usher, the woman is a sight, whatever it is. It'll say all sorts of things. But you should never learn halacha from signs. It's not the Pashkevilim. It's not good. But it is a machlokas. Now there were even some rabbis in America, some poskim in America, who actually thought the shaitel was better than other coverings, because the shaitel you can actually cover more hair with other coverings, some amount of hair will come out, etc. So all you can see is that many B'nai Torah wives do wear shaitel. So it's very hard to be mavatel ayan haga that so many people do have. Yeah.
Even when this halacha is wrong, even everybody makes a mistake, you should not follow the mistake.
No, that of course is true. But what I'm saying is that there are poskim that say the shaitel is okay. You know, so people have a makom to be so mechan. If they have a makom to be so mechan, then you're not supposed to criticize them as arvayonim.
Is this a kula?
Well, most would say it's a kula. On the other hand, I had mentioned that some poskim actually say it is a chumra because the shaitel covers more hair than would be the case without the shaitel. So some say for keret, the shaitel is the chumra. Yeah.
In the Megillah for the reading, it says like, how does Mordechai, since Mordechai, he's the author of the Megillah, right? So how does he know some of the conversations between like Haman, Haman, and his soldiers? He wasn't there, so how does he know what they said?
Yeah, you know, that's an excellent question. And the Gemara in Megillah itself asks exactly that question, and it proves from there the principle that Megillah Esther was written with divine inspiration. And the Gemara even says, because otherwise, how would the author, Mordechai, would even know that these conversations occurred? So the answer would be there was the equivalent of some type of divine inspiration that told him what the words were. That's correct. Even though, of course, you know, everyone knows one of the most famous aspects of Megillah Esther is that Hashem's name is not mentioned in the entire Megillah, which is quite amazing. A Sefer of Tanakh that does not mention Hashem's name. And the reason that's given, the standard explanation is that the Megillah represents the concealment of Hashem, how Hashem operates, not through open miracles, not through supernatural things like Kriyas Yamsuf, but through events that if you're not a Maamin, you would just think is coincidence. And that's why Esther, the word Esther itself means Hester, concealment. And that is shown by even when you think Hashem is not here, he is really creating the reality, right? So that's a very important yesod of the Nes Nister. Yeah, in the back, yeah, again.
Yeah, I have another question about Shlomo HaMelech. I mean, we learned in the Chumash is brought down what a true king should be like.
What should be like?
A king, yeah. He should not have many women, not many horses.
Right.
He should not go to Egypt.
Yeah.
Shlomo HaMelech was
I mean, Mama is the opposite. I don't know how many.
Kind
of women, I don't know how many.
Thousands.
Yeah. And many horses, and was exploring in richness. And
yep.
It's but clear that he is not like a king, and still he's called the one of the biggest people of our generation.
So the Gemara in Sanhedrin says the following. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says, why does the Torah not give you reasons for mitzvahs? Right? A lot of mitzvahs, we don't have a reason. Don't wear shatnas. Why don't we have a reason? There is certainly a reason. Even for chukim, that the reason eludes us. There is a reason. We just don't know what it is. So the Gemara says, I'll tell you why. Because there are two mitzvahs where the Torah gives a reason, and look what happened. The Torah says, a king shall not have many wives. Because no more than 18. A king can have up to 18. But no more than 18 wives. Lest he get distracted from his responsibilities. He shall not have a lot of gold and silver, lest he become arrogant and gaivadik, because he's so wealthy. So, the Torah gave a reason. Shlomo HaMelech said, the Torah gave a reason. That's not going to happen to me. I will have a lot of wives, and I'm not going to get distracted. I'm going to have a lot of gold and silver. I will not become arrogant. In other words, he made Olam D'Shecheshman. He said, the Torah gave a reason. The reason doesn't apply to me. I can go ahead and do it. What happens, of course, is the reason did apply to him. And all the things the Torah said happened to him. Which means the lesson here is, and this is still what people do today, people say, oh, the reason for kosher is, you know, health reasons, trichinosis. In other words, people say it doesn't apply to me. Therefore, Hashem says, you know, I'm not going to give reasons. I'm just going to tell them, this is the law. You have no way of knowing whether it applies to you or not, because you don't even know the reason in the first place. So this is exactly the cheshbon, that these two commandments were a test case. They were an experiment. I mean, Hashem knew the result ahead of time, in which Hashem said, okay, I'm going to give people the reasons and see what happens. And the answer is, everybody says, oh, not everybody, some people say, the reason doesn't apply to me. I'm different. So that's what happens. So, and the lesson is a very sober lesson, because Shlomo is indeed the Chacham Mikol Adam, the wisest of all people. He is the greatest in wisdom, and yet it even happened to him. That's a pretty powerful lesson. If it happened to him, it would certainly happen to me. So I better be careful. Now the emesis, Shlomo, of course, according to the Gemara, lost his malchus. According to Shlomo, was deposed. Shlomo, again, there's a whole story. Ashmedai, the king of the Shadim, it's a whole story in Maseches Gittin and in the Medrash. He got thrown to a faraway land, and he had to wander for a very, very long time. According to one view in the Gemara, he never even became king again, which is not mashma in the Psukim, that he died in exile. According to another view, he finally found his way back after years. But according to the Medrash, there were years that he was not a melech. And then he came back a humble person and a Baal Shuvah, and then he became he died as a very, very great, great, great tzaddik. In the book of Koheles, it talks about, I went from place to place. So Chazal says, it's a reference not to Shlomo giving sermons in Yerushalayim, but he literally wandered from place to place as a commoner. So it was a very, very devastating aspect. Shlomo was nenesh for this. It's also brought down that actually it's not brought down, it's in the Psukim themselves, that the splitting of the kingdom, remember that under Shlomo's son, 10 tribes broke away from the Malchus of Rechavim, and they founded the northern kingdom. The Navi says this was a punishment to Shlomo, but because of David HaMelech, Hashem would not bring the evil decree during the lifetime of David's son. It was deferred until the grandson. So the onish was the losing of ten out of 12, 5/6 of the kingdom was ripped away. So it's a serious thing. Yeah.
If knowing the timing is such a bad thing, so yep. Why would the Sefer Chinuch write?
Yeah, it's a good question. There were those that felt we should not look at Taimei HaMitzvos because it would be machshelus. But the short answer is there is a nafkamina between the Eibishter giving a Tam and we giving a Tam. Meaning if the Eibishter gives a Tam, that's the reason. And then bedafka, people might be nichshol by saying the reason doesn't apply. When we give taimim, we know ahead of time that we're only saying it bederech efsher. So when it's bederech efsher, there's not going to be a takala because we're only saying it bederech efsher, and therefore people will not make a judgment. The reason doesn't apply to me. Therefore, because who knows whether the reason is the right reason? That's why the Sefer HaChinuch writes in the Hakdama that there are many, many, many reasons for mitzvos, and I'm going to give something that are possible reasons, but they're lav dafka muchrich. But what the Eberster says is muchrich. So bedafka in a muchrich, there's more of a sakana. You'll say, oh, that's the reason. So that's not nogeya. Nogeya. Yeah.
I have a question to what the rabbi said. That Hashem punished the grandson of David.
Yeah.
But he punished his people because of Shlomo's sins. So it's not. I understand if Shlomo HaMelech would be somehow punished or his. Somehow, but he punished Dafka other people who are not at fault what he did. So.
Yeah. Well, a melech is different than a regular person. Normally, if a one person does an aveira, Hashem does not punish other people because of the aveira. But a melech, the Rambam says, is the lev ha'am. The melech is the heart of the people. And as is it were, the whole people are the collective body, and the melech is the heart and the soul. So when a melech sins, there are going to be repercussions for the whole nation of Israel. Yeah.
Learning in Sukkah, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says that him and his son and Yonatan ben Uziah would be able to patter the entire world from its creation until its end.
Yeah.
And my question is why? Because Rashi says Yonatan ben Uziah was the most righteous of all the kings. Why?
I'm sorry, which kings did you say it again?
Yonatan ben Uziah.
Well, again, so your question is what? Why was he the most righteous of the kings?
What makes him special? Why was he?
Yeah, it's very interesting. We know very little about him. One thing we know about him that's quite interesting is that his father, who was a king, Uziyahu was the only king who became a leper. He became a mitzora. Why did he become a mitzora? Because he wanted to. Well, he thought he was the melech, but he also wanted to be Kohen Gadol. So he went. He went into the Kodesh HaKadoshim to do the Aveda, and Hashem didn't zap him dead, but Hashem gave him something that maybe was even worse, kind of a living death. He gave him the mark of Tzaras on his forehead, as if to say, "You're totally rejected. Not only can you not be a Kohen, you cannot even be with Jews, because the Metzora has the only tumah that has to be Chutz L'machana in quarantine." And it mentions that normally Tzaras goes away. That's why the Torah has a ceremony. When Tzaras goes away, you bring sacrifices. His Tzaras remained for the rest of his life. Many years. He was a Metzora in quarantine. And the child who took over the kingship in the lifetime of his father was Yotam. Yotam was, in fact, Yotam is Merumas. Yotam is the same letters as Yosom, which is an orphan. Because effectively, he was orphaned from his father, even though his father was alive, by his father being a Mitzora. Seen in this way, Yosam was someone who restored the idea of serving Hashem properly, because his father was so brazen to literally go into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, not being a Kohen, not being on Yom Kippur. And Yosam, instead of following his father's bad example, was Machzer Am Yisrael, to a certain state of tshuva. So that's a very, very great thing. You find in the book of Malachim several instances where a very, very righteous king came from a very evil king. Of course, you have the opposite as well. Chizkiyo, who was the most righteous of all the kings, his father was Achaz. His father was a Russia. Of course, his Chizkiyo's son was Menashe, who was also a Russia. So it goes both ways. But you'll find that Chazal or Mishabeach very much a righteous person who comes from a parent that was not righteous. That was the Maila of Yosef. Yeah.
What are two studim for cigarettes to be either mutter or usser? And on a minimal level, I guess I would think that there's a minus chassidus to not smoke, but because I find it surprising that there were gedolim that also smoked cigarettes. And I would think at least on Amidas Chassidus level that there would be no.
Listen, there is no question that if you ask any posek in the world. Should I start smoking? They will tell a person, you should not start smoking, and might even be usher to start smoking. But the two studim are relatively simple. Tzad number one, ta'aser, is probably an easier thing to understand, and that is, since smoking increases the risks of lung cancer and emphysema, so therefore you're not allowed to do things that cause sakana to the body, and that would be the reason to aser. Now, interestingly enough, although that sounds like a pashut reason, very, very few poskim have said it is usher to smoke. They have soft-pedaled it. They have said, not good to smoke, a person should not smoke, etc., bad idea, don't start. But very few have absolutely said it was usher. Tzitz Eliezer is almost the only one that said it is usher to smoke and you're obligated to stop. Most have not said that. Perhaps because nobody would listen to them. It's very difficult. But so what would the svara be that it wouldn't be usher? So there are two svaras that they say why you can't absolutely say that it's usher. Svara number one is that the damage of cigarettes is the danger of cigarettes is cumulative, it's not individual. So each individual cigarette, one cannot say this is gorim sakana. I understand they say that even a single cigarette already does something, but it will not do anything that will be a permanent harm, and therefore the issur of sakana is only when you're doing a single pa'ula that is sakana, not when it's cumulative. The other is a little more complex. It is based on a statistical argument. And the statistical argument is sakana defined by the objective risk or by the magnification of the risk? By that I mean the following. Let me give you a pesticide example. Let's imagine that the certain occurrence of a cancer is one in a million. But if they use a pesticide and people will ingest that pesticide, it will be one in 100,000. Now, there are two ways you could describe that phenomenon. You could say this pesticide increases cancer by 1,000%. Going from a million to 100,000, that's 10 times. That's 1,000. Now that sounds really awful. In other words, it is 1,000 times more likely that you'll get cancer if you eat this food. Now that sounds, instinctively, that sounds, oh, for sure that's going to be usher. 1,000 times more likely. Or another way of saying it is, 1 in 100,000 people are going to get cancer. That doesn't sound so bad because even in driving, right, the risks are going to be greater than that. So the shaila is like this. When the Torah asers doing dangerous things, is it focusing on how much more is the danger magnified connected normal activity, in which case the magnification is 1,000%, and that would be usher? Or is 1 in 100,000 not such a big deal? You see what I'm saying? That's the question. Now with cigarettes it's the same thing. Cigarettes greatly increases the probability. But still, most people who smoke are not going to get lung cancer. So if you looked at it as, it's not dangerous because the rove of people don't get sick, it would be mucher. If you look at it as how much it increases the probability, then it would be usher. So this is a very, very interesting shaila that permeates many, many risky activities. Pesticides and medicines and all sorts of things. Are you looking at the objective risk of rove and miyut, or are you looking at how much the risk is magnified? That would be the svara. Yeah.
Does anyone agree in regards to Aminus Chassidus? Like if you put someone on a much higher level, a gadol, whatever it may be, you would think that at least on that level, they would be smoking.
Yeah. First of all, I want to point out that the Chafetz Chaim, now the Surgeon General's report in the United States that smoking is injurious to health, and that's when they stopped advertising cigarettes on television and magazines, that came out in the 1960s. And I still remember the day when they used to have cigarette commercials and the like. But the Chafetz Chaim must have written maybe in the late 1800s that smoking is a very, very, almost Ruach HaKodesh, that smoking is a very, very bad habit, and he's very disturbed that religious Jews are smoking. Now, he had a few reasons. Part of it was, he said, it affects health, which is interesting because at the time they used to say cigarette smoking promotes health. If you would go back to a magazine advertisement in the 1930s or 40s, they would say it promotes digestion and relaxes the system. They actually said it was not. The Chafetz Chaim said it's not healthy. He didn't say cancer, but he said it's not healthy. He also said it was bittel Torah, but that doesn't apply. So that applied when you used to have to roll your cigarettes. He said you have to get the paper, get the tobacco. Okay, that was maybe a separate cheshbon. But the Chafetz Chaim Vadai says a religious person should not smoke. Now it's recorded that the Stipler, who was a heavy smoker, Rav Chaim Kanevsky does not smoke, but the Stipler was a heavy smoker. Actually, almost all people who came from Russia at that time were heavy smokers. That was just part of the culture. He said, towards the end of his life, it's a pretty strong statement, he said, he forgives everybody who ever did anything to him, except for the person who introduced him to smoking. Because he said, I hope it's not Lashon Hara, he said that, you know, he worked on himself and he could stop all sorts of bad things. He says, he didn't have the kayach to stop this. And he really, really felt bad. So he certainly would say it's a midas chasidus. Now, there is an issue of secondhand smoke as well, which is an interesting shaila, and that is, even if you're smoking and you're allowed to smoke, but if you're doing it in a way that's mafria other people, whether it's a health risk, as many people say, or even if it's just something that makes other people uncomfortable, one is not allowed to do that either. There's a bein adam l'chaveiro aspect. Now, I don't agree. I was at a chasna a while ago, and you know, under Israeli law, you're not supposed to smoke in a wedding hall or whatever it is. So there was an old yid that was smoking. It was Meir Sharim, so nobody enforces that. I mean, so people are smoking. So there was a fellow, a young guy, not from here, but he might even be from here, I'm not sure, but he's a Baal Tshuva, he's a newcomer. And he just went over. He went over to this old Jew. He pulled the cigarette out of his mouth and he extinguished it. So then he wants us to give him a hechsher. He started going to rabbis for sure that all the rabbis would tell him, oh, great thing, mitzvah. Absolutely not. You don't go over to somebody like that. If you're not comfortable, good, whether they should smoke or not is another chesed, but if you're not comfortable, then get out of the wedding hall. You don't, or ask someone to walk away. But, says, why didn't you ask the person to smoke outside? He says, well, he was too old to walk. He wouldn't have been able to walk. So because he can't walk out, I just grabbed a cigarette from him. It's a great bizillion. So do not be overzealous in this, although it is true that smoking is a bad thing. Yeah.
The question is, can the room give us a svar according to those rabbanim that say saying Lashon Hara to someone that's not Shomer Shabbos?
I'm saying two non Shomer Shabbos or about a non Shomer Shabbos?
About someone that's not Shomer Shabbos, one can speak Lashon Hara about him.
Yeah. So, okay. I don't want to necessarily say that halacha l'maisa we always apply that, but there is a because again, what is the lashon hara? Is many lavin, but the basic lav is lo seilech rachil bi'amecha. You shall not be a tales bearer, one who bears tales amongst your nation, amecha. And Chazal point out that certain lashonis like amecha or re'echa, your friend, connotes a commonality in Torah and mitzvos. And therefore, those who are not shomer Torah and mitzvos are not nichlal in amecha. That's called eisa maisa amcha. They are doing what a Jewish person does. That would be the basis of the heter. Now, let me point out, one has to be very careful in such a heter for the following reason. First of all, it's not so pashut that every Mechalel Shabbos would fall into this category of someone who is rejecting Am Yisrael. We do have the concept of Tinok Shenishpa, someone who never had the backgrounds, who is Lav Dafka a Russia. Number two, we do have the aspect of Chilul Hashem, because if people see a religious Jew who discriminately says bad things about other people, then they're going to think about this Jew that he doesn't care about people and the like, and you do have to be concerned for Chilul Hashem. And number three, there is a svar that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky said, and that is, midos are not divisible. And that is, if you get into the habit of speaking bad about anybody, even Goyim, by definition, you're going to get into the habit and you'll speak badly about religious Jews as well. Meaning you can't divide your midos that way. If you become a person who likes to gossip, it's contagious in other areas. So for that reason, it is not kedai to be mishtamish in those heterim, with one exception, and that is, if the need to speak Lashon Hara is to prevent people from learning from their bad ways, then that would be good and permissible, because that way you're telling people to avoid bad influences. But if you're not doing it for that reason, you just want to, you know, say humiliating things about somebody, even if technically it may not be an issur of Lashon Hara, it's not a good idea to do. And in fact, you'll find, you don't find chashuva people, you know, saying, oh, that guy is not religious, but, you know, he does this and that. And, you know, I mean, if it's not l'tayelis, keep away from it. Yeah?
Would that also mean that if one of the people who are not included amongst Amecha or Reyacha is speaking to someone who is in Reyacha or Amecha about someone else who's in Reyacha or Amecha, would that count by that?
I'm not following.
The Rosh Hashanah is saying to someone in the Amecha about another person in the Amecha.
Oh, I see. You're asking me, if I'm not religious, maybe I don't have an issur of speaking Lashon Hara because I'm not in the same. That's interesting. So you're telling me, so a non-Shomer Shabbos doesn't have the issur of Lashon Hara on a Shomer Shabbos. That is an interesting kasha, but for my, so we, it doesn't work that way. We only use it. In other words, We only use it legabe the subject and not the one that's speaking Lashon Hara, but it is a good kasha. Yeah.
Four whiskeys which were by some Poskim allowed that were matured in sherry casks.
Yeah, the scotch.
People are saying it was just based on a mistake of the actual facts. So what's is that true?
Yeah. Just to be sure that people understand this, you know, people love scotch. That Rav Schiller has a whole mahalech. How did scotch get the sechus of being the epitome of what you serve at a Jewish simcha? And he said, I have no idea if this is true. He said Scotland was the only country in Europe that never persecuted Jews. I don't know how many Jews there were in Scotland, and therefore HaKadosh Baruch Hu rewarded Scotland with the idea of that scotch has a pride of place at every Yiddish simcha, of quality at least. But in scotch, of course, there are different types. There's blended scotch, you know, the Johnny Walker, the red, which is, you know, not so good, and the black, you know, you go up in Madrigos and the like. But then we have the single malt scotch, which everyone loves single malt scotch. So the problem is that a lot of single malt scotch, if it's not certified kosher, what happens is it is aged for many years, sometimes 20 years, many years sometimes. It's aged in barrels of oak barrels. And in order to give it a shtickel taste, these are barrels which had sherry in them. Sherry is wine, a certain type of wine. And that imparts a certain, again, I don't taste any of this, but you know, those who are in the know, they see it imparts a certain taste to the scotch. Now the problem is, sherry is treif. Sherry is wine that's handled by non-Jews. And wine that is handled or touched by non-Jews is treif. So in a sense, in all scotch, although the ingredients of scotch are all kosher ingredients, right? Scotch, there's nothing treif in scotch, but the problem is if it was aged in sherry, it is a taruvos, it is a mixture with this non-kosher wine. So the big, big question is, can those single malt scotches be drunk? So there are many people who said yes, because whatever amount of sherry goes into the scotch is batel b'shishim. There is many, many more times the scotch than there is the wine. And if something forbidden gets mixed in, it's batel b'shishim, right? 60 to 1. This is 100 to 1, 200 to 1, 300 to 1, and the like. So there's somech on batel b'shishim. Others say, no, how can you have bitul b'shishim? The whole svar of bitul b'shishim is you can't taste it. If I can't taste it, so it's not like milk. A drop of milk that falls into a cauldron of soup, fleishik soup, I can eat the soup because the milk cannot be tasted. Here, bedafka, it's there to be tasted, and therefore it's not shaykh bitul b'shishim. So this is a very, very big machlokas. Some poskim matured, some poskim asered. The truth of the matter is, it is absolutely better to be machmir. Now, this issue of that the poskim who matured made a mistake, I don't know if that's true. Maybe that's what the machmirim are saying. But one way or the other, it is much, much better to be machmer. One should not rely on the heterim, because there is a principle in Shulchan Aruch that anything that is added to a mixture deliberately to enhance the taste, and that's why it's put in, one cannot rely on the halachic principle of nullification. Nullification deals with accidental mixtures. Accidental mixtures meaning by accident the milk, you know, fell into the meat soup. It does not apply to things that are introduced intentionally to enhance taste. So I'm not going to say that it was a mistake. I don't know, but b'chalapachas, it's better to be machmer. Yeah.
I heard recently that davar shel kedusha could only be said in front of makom mechusa.
Yes.
Does that mean that, let's say, like, when you're at your Shabbos table, and let's say either your siblings or people around you are wearing, let's say, not as not makom mechusa?
Yep.
Does that mean you can't, like, say berakat hamazon in front of that?
This is a real problem. This really deserves a whole shiur of its own. There is a law in Shulchan Aruch. From the Gemara, really, that you're not allowed to say brachos, kriya shema, davening, or divrei Torah. You're allowed to think, but you're not allowed to verbalize. You're not allowed to verbalize divrei Torah or benching or davening if you are facing somebody who is not dressed in the proper laws of tznius, and this even applies to your own wife and your own daughter. So all of the heterim that we have, I'm allowed to have yichud with my daughter, I'm allowed to hug my daughter, kolish, I'm allowed to listen to my daughter's voice, all of those things, they are heterim, to be sure, but they don't allow you to say dvarim shebikdiv. One has to remember this. There is no wife or daughter exception for this halacha. Now that would actually mean that I'm not allowed to. Now, zemiras is a machlokas. Some treat zemiras, they say, since zemiras are not official davening, they do matir zemiras. But even learning out loud would be a halachic problem. But b'di'eved, the etza is that if you're looking at the sefer and you're not looking up at the erva, so to speak, so you are allowed to, as long as you keep your eyes away. This is the heter of learning in a bus. It is a problem. How can I learn in a bus? So many people are not sanua. So again, if I'm learning with machshava alone, that's not a problem, Taka. But if I want to verbalize the words, so we're somech on looking at the sefer, but you have to be really careful. Because, you know, the head moves up and down, and when the head is up and something comes into your range and vision, there is an issur. Now, it happens to be, without getting into all of the details, it happens to be that there's a famous, famous leniency of the Aruch HaShulchan that says that uncovered hair of a married woman might be different, because since so many women don't cover the hair, although it's against halacha, it's no longer sexually stimulating as opposed to above the knee and the like. So the Aruch HaShulchan matirs Devarim Shebekedusha keneged uncovered hair. The Mishnah Berurah seems to argue with that. Rav Moshe says, B'shas Hadchak, you could be somech of that. But that is only talking about hair. Whatever that is, that's only hair. That is not talking about sleeves, and it's not talking about dresses and the like. Same problem at a wedding. I mean, I'll give you an example. Mesader Kedushin at a wedding, who is reciting brachos under the chuppah, or anybody reciting a bracha. And then you have, well, sometimes even the kala is not dressed in it, but let's assume even if it's a frum wedding, but you may have the mother. Now, again, in Eretz Yisrael, I've seemed to notice that kind of even non-religious people, they kind of follow the minute. Maybe they're told ahead of time, you better do this. But in America, it's very, very common that, you know, even if it's a frum wedding, sometimes a relative will come up not dressed sanua. So the Masada Kedushin has to be careful to look in the sitter. Did you have a just follow up?
Yeah. What about, like, in terms of, like, here verban, like at, like, college campuses, or giving, like, shiurim?
Yeah. So here we have a psak of the Chazon Ish. Here we have a very interesting psak, and only a gadol could say this. I couldn't say this. The Chazon Ish says that even though you should not daven in front of women that are not dressed sanias, you are permitted to give shiurei Torah in front of such women, and you don't have to look away, because looking away would look bad as well. Look away, because he says he literally applies the rule of eis lasos lashem, that when there's a time to stand up for kavod shemayim, there are times, we have to be careful, there are times when Chazal say, break the Torah in the interest of keeping the Torah alive. Now, that doesn't apply to my davening. Why do I have to daven facing a woman? But when it comes to a shir, where if you don't look at the audience, they're going to think you're crazy, and they're not going to listen to you, and so that'll prevent them from coming to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the Chazanish specifically said, for Shiurei Torah, it is mutter to look, as long as you're not, this is always subjective, as long as you're not mechaveing for Tai Vandal.
That would mean even us ourselves saying Divrei Torah, talking about like our family or whatever.
That would be Nichlal and Eish Lasos L'Shem, yeah, but that's different than benching. When you're benching, look in the bencher. Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. Pants, a woman wearing pants,
It depends. If the pants are tight, they are the same as Erva Mamish. If they're loose, they would not be. So you know, it depends. Yeah. Yeah, it's the last question.
Yeah. What's the reason that many Ashkenazim in Chutzlars are makel with Kemach Yashan?
Well, this is a huge issue. Again, these are things that need a whole shear. The basic idea is that the Ramah matters. Because like this, there is, number one, a machlokas in the Gemara itself. If Chadash applies in Chutz Laretz, it is a machlokas. So the Ramah says, since it's a machlokas, even though we're machmir, if we know that it's Chadash, we're machmir, but the Ramah says, on any grain, there is a sfeik sfeika. First of all, maybe the grain is from an old year, because wheat is stockpiled for many years, not many years, but for some years. And second of all, even if it was a new year, but maybe it rooted before Pesach, because even if it was harvested this year, if it was Nishrash, Kaidam La'imer, the Eimer Matyrs. So the Ramah Matyrs mitam Sveik Sveika, and many people are Somech on the Ramah and Chutz La'aretz, but the truth of the matter is it's better to be Machmer. In fact, if you had to choose Chumras, I mean, Chadash is actually of greater significance than even Chol of Yisrael, because Chol of Yisrael at most is a Chiyuv Drabanan. A Chadash, like those opinions, might be an Isser D'Oraisa in Chutz Laretz. So if you had, I mean, you shouldn't only have one Chumrah, but if you had to pick one Chumrah in the laws of Kashrus, Chadash might be the Chumrah to actually go with in that way. But now, again, this needs more time. I mean, there are all sorts of guides, like how do you know, there are product codes and the like, and Lakewood published a whole guide, how do you identify from product codes when something was harvested, and that'll tell you exactly. Now, the good thing about Chadash is, all Chadash eventually becomes Yashan, right? So if I buy something, then I know for sure that the grain product will become Yashan by the second day of Pesach. It'll become Yashan, right? So all Chadash eventually does become Yashan. That's why people stockpile. So they buy all sorts of stuff, and it'll then become Yashan, and they'll have it for the whole year. Okay, we'll stop here. Okay.